This is Yin Radio. This is KRFP Moscow, Pullman, and you are listening to Yin Radio. Now, fall has officially arrived despite the warm weather. The solstice has passed and our nights are actually getting longer now as we prepare for a more internal time. October is around the corner with the festivals of harvest, corn mazes, pumpkin patches, and the beautiful colors of all the changing leaves. It can be a time of year to release our fast paces, find solace in our homes and with our friends and families. But what if our family is a place of fear? What if there's no solace in one's home? If violence rules the domestic sphere, this internal time of year becomes sometimes a time of even further isolation. I bring this up because October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. By now, most people have at least heard the dismal statistic that 1 in 4 women are abused by their partners, and some might realize that it crosses all classes, races, stereotypes. The statistics can be difficult to pin down, but violence impacts men, the LGBTQ community, and the reality is there is no one characterization of a victim or a survivor, just as there is no single element to look for in a perpetrator. If you visit the Yin Radio website, which I should mention here now, I'm in the process of establishing. Yin has had a long history with various affiliations through the U of I and then here in the community. And at the current time, we have a Facebook page, which is just Yin Radio on Facebook, Y-I-N-R-A-D-I-O on Facebook. But we are needing a new website. So I'm in the process of setting that up. And I mention this for two reasons. One is because I want you to know in this next couple weeks, you'll be able to go and look at our archives. And in terms of what I was just speaking of, we do have some back archives featuring different aspects of domestic violence from previous hosts. And I want you to have access to that on the site. The other reason is that for this show, some of the resources that are mentioned by those that were interviewed are going to be available on the website. And I didn't have time to put those pieces up today, but hopefully later tonight I'll have those on there. So as of this week, you'll be able to go and find some of these resources that you might want to look at in terms of gathering further information you may need for your own personal information. And we have many organizations here in town that are working with domestic violence. And so, so I just want to make sure you have access to those pieces. The website I'm establishing is a WordPress site and it's yinradioblog.wordpress.com. So Y-I-N-R-A-D-I-O dot WordPress, which is WordPress.com. So that's just to get us started here. And because we have different aspects being covered through our past archives, and then in relation to some of the things that have been going on recently here in Moscow, this year I decided to focus upon a closely related element, which is sexual assault and violence on campus. The University of Idaho held its Safety Week last week here in Moscow. Safety Week was organized several years ago in response to the killing of Katie Benoy, a University of Idaho student. Her family wanted something positive to celebrate her life that could also be of benefit to others, so the Benoy family and the University of Idaho worked together to develop a comprehensive program for students, especially new undergrads, to the university to educate and empower them around the issues of violence and sexual assault on campus. I apologize, I don't have the stat right in front of me, and it's mentioned in the interviews, but actually the first weeks back to school are apparently the time when you can expect the highest percentage of sexual assault. And so that's in and of itself a very telling statistic. And so this Safety Week has been very important. This year's events included a screening of a documentary called The Hunting Ground, which takes a close and incredibly disturbing look at the ways in which academic institutions in the United States have covered up the issue of sexual assault on campus for economic purposes, And there was also a Take Back the Night march, which does have a long history in this country and is a powerful reminder that we have all been touched by violence, whether ourselves or through being witness to the violence against those we love. I attended the screening of The Hunting Ground, put on by the University of Idaho at the Kenworthy Theater, and then the panel discussion that ensued. And despite the harsh reality of the ways in which institutions around the country have failed their students in preventing proper handling of assault cases, the University of Idaho seemed to be far ahead of the curve. We're going to go ahead and take a listen here to a clip from Virginia Solan speaking, introducing the film, The Hunting Ground.
The one thing that's really clear to me is that every single person in this room has been touched by violence. We're all touched by violence. We're all connected to this issue. And that's why everybody is invited to work with us for culture change. Culture change begins with communication, and that's why we're here tonight. Quite a few universities have worked to block this film. It raises tough questions. Our new dean of students, Blaine Eccles, and vice provost of enrollment and student affairs, Jean Kim, are among its strongest supporters, as critical to the conversations we need to have here in Moscow. When I asked Dr. Eccles if he would support showing The Hunting Ground, his answer was, absolutely.
So that was Virginia Solan introducing The Hunting Ground, the documentary that was shown as part of the University of Idaho Safety Week here last week. I attended that event, and I do have to say that it was impressive the way that the University of Idaho was there to support a film that is otherwise pointing to the issues of structural violence inherent in institutional dealing with sexual assault. So for this week's Ian broadcast, I wanted to share some of the input from two amazing women that have been dedicated to violence prevention here in the area. Virginia Solano, as we just heard, the violence prevention coordinator at U of I, has been working in this field for some time. And when we get to her interview, we'll have a more comprehensive introduction. But she is just an amazing, amazing person to work with, to speak to. And her clarity on these issues is absolutely wonderful. And then I also had the opportunity to speak with Amber Morchek, a PhD student at WSU working as assistant to violence prevention programs on the WSU campus. And again, another amazing woman who just has so much experience. She's studying within the criminal justice field. And so I've really appreciated all of her input as well. And I know you will as well. So I interviewed these two women both earlier this week by phone, and we'll get to those interviews after we play some selections from the Take Back the Night, which includes some spoken word poetry. What I discovered in speaking with and listening to the speeches of these amazing women is that we are at an entirely new frontier in working with violence on campus and violence in our society as a whole. As a result of bystander prevention programs, Green Dot being our local example of the national program, the culture of violence itself on campus and also burgeoning out into our society as a whole is changing. Some of the material I present here today may be difficult. And like I said, I'll offer links to various readings, groups, and resources on the Palouse that are indicated within the interviews and were provided to me also by Amber Morchek and Virginia Solan so that you can refer to them in any of the ways in which you need them. Despite the years that I have worked with survivors of various violent traumas in my own healing arts practice and given my own experiences with this issue, I still found myself in frustration, in tears, and in a state of agitation over the course of time that I've been working to compile this information for today's broadcast. And of course, on one level, that's how we respond to an issue that is so large and so difficult that impacts us all. And at the same time, that's why we need to also take care of ourselves. So as you listen, just please do make sure if you need to stop, if you're listening to the poetry at any point and you need a break, to reach out to those around you to talk. The point in all of this is the need for communication, the need to stop the silence. And that is why we continue to speak, to reach out, and to work towards an end to violence as a whole. I hope that with today's broadcast, without diminishing what is yet left to be done or the severity of the violence that has been suffered in this country at large, I hope you find that the broadcast is inspirational, as inspirational as I found these women and these programs that they are a part of to be. Welcome back to Yin Radio. That was Lady Gaga with her song Till It Happens to You. And it was actually composed for the documentary I mentioned, The Hunting Ground, which was shown as part of the University of Idaho Safety Week last Friday at the Kenworthy Theater. And it's pretty powerful. She's actually created a video to it, which I watched the other night and found myself in tears, too. I thought it was actually really moving, and really appreciate the way so many artists and women who are willing to be vocal have been speaking out towards this issue. So, again, today we're focusing on the issue of sexual assault on campus, and this is part of upcoming October National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. What we're going to move on to next is a clip from the new vice provost at the U of I, Jean Kim, who introduced the history of the Take Back the Night, which was one of the other major events that was held for Safety Week this last Thursday on the University of Idaho campus.
Hello. I want to thank you for the opportunity to join you in this very important program. And as some of you may know, I am relatively new to the university, having joined University of Idaho in January of this year. And while many universities sponsor Take Back the Night events, I wasn't sure if that was the case here at University of Idaho. And so imagine how delighted I was to find out not only do we sponsor Take Back the Night march and rally here, but also we do a whole week of program around safety. So I'm really happy, and I also want to underscore the thank you that was done by Becca for all the folks who have made this event for tonight possible, as well as the whole event for the week, including what's going to happen tomorrow night as well. So thank you to all of you. And as some of you may know, the Take Back the Night marches and events surrounding Take Back the Night began back in early 1970s. And it continues to the present day, obviously, and it is really national and international in its scope. And in this country, one of the very first Take Back the Night marches was held in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in October of 1975, after the murder of a microbiologist, Susan Alexander Speet, who was stabbed to death while walking home alone at night. Take Back the Night events typically consist of a rally followed by a march, and sometimes and often a speak out or candlelight vigil on violence against women. And in doing the early marches, like the ones that I used to participate in during the late 70s and 80s, these marches were often deliberately women only in order to symbolize women's individual walk through darkness and to demonstrate that women united can resist fear and violence. Since then, of course, the Take Back the Night events have evolved to include men as victims, as bystanders, and as supporters. And while the march began as a way to protest violence against women that the women experienced while walking in public at night, the purpose of these marches was to speak out against this violence, but more importantly, to raise the community's awareness around these violence against women as a preventative measure against future violence. The Take Back the Night program has also grown to encompass all forms of violence against all persons, although sexual violence against women still is the top focus. And the word night, originally meant to be taken literally to express the fear that many women feel during the night, and I must say, myself included, but has since changed to symbolize fear of violence in general. And this helps the movement incorporate other feminist concerns, such as domestic violence, dating violence, and sexual abuse within the home. However it is organized, the common purpose of Take Back the Night events is to advocate for the rights of everyone to feel safe from sexual violence. And I'd like to underscore that and repeat it one more time. It is to advocate for the right of everyone to feel safe from sexual violence. I want to ask you now to raise your hand if you have experienced sexual violence yourself or know of someone who has experienced sexual violence. So many of you in this room. And I would say that as long as any hand goes up in response to this request, it is important for us to continue to offer opportunities for people to participate in programs such as Take Back the Night. So thank you very much for being here, and I look forward to being with you for the rest of the evening. Thank you.
That was Vice Provost Jean Kim speaking before the Take Back the Night march and rally that occurred this last Thursday on the University of Idaho campus. And that same evening, three student activists gave spoken word performances, and Becca Miller McPhee, the Assistant Director of Programs at the Women's Center for the University of Idaho, introduces each of the female students who spoke. We're going to be listening to Mimi Price, Samantha Hansen, and Jessie Forsmo Shadid. So please have a listen here and enjoy.
So now it is my absolute honor to introduce our student poets. They're going to share their stories with you through spoken word, and I know that as these talented students share their words and experiences with us, you will show them the utmost respect. Prepare to be moved. Our first poet is Mimi Price. Mimi is a fierce advocate for social justice who isn't afraid to argue or stand up for what she believes in. She transferred to the University of Idaho in the fall of 2014 and is currently a co-chair of the feminist-led activist movement To Empower, known as FLAME. Let's hear her story.
Before, it can be emotionally moving. It's very personal, so you know, clap at the end. Snaps are always a really good thing in the middle of a spoken word. They let the artists know that you like what they're doing and you support them. So yeah, snaps. There we go, we all know it. All right, everyone ready? Awesome, I'm a little bit nervous. I can't tell. Okay. Father, intimidator. Crack knuckles on my mother's cesarean stitches, leaving scars of abuse. A skull collided with countertops, slammed doors, and a disguised bruise. Toddler years remembered by days without tears, seldom and far between. Be a good girl. Lover, predator. 23 to my 11, hot single near me, bark bad as his bite. My lips never felt as foreign as they did pressed against yours. Be a good girl. I'm forgetting how. My roommate's boyfriend. Christmas break, 20 texts buzzing, begging for a woman's touch. My broken, beaten soul crying in exhaustion. My ponytail gripped in your fist. My tears on your shorts made waterboarding a familiar feeling. Be a good girl. I can't take this anymore. Boyfriend, trusted and true. But iron burns and eyes bruised blue, no escape from a fate like you. But friends see pain in worn-out souls. Be a good girl. I'll be no more. You know what? I give up. This cycle has to end. Too many lies that broke me down. Too many times I made no sound. No voice, no noise. Be a good girl. I will not. I'll be a strong woman because enough is enough. Thank you.
Our next poet is Samantha Hansen. Samantha describes herself as lucky to be adjacent to so many different communities on campus, and yet to be able to forge her own way in traditional Vandal style. She's worked with the Office of Multicultural Affairs, ASUI, the LGBTQA Office, the Women's Center, the Violence Prevention Office, and currently she is significantly involved in a group called Moscow Spoken Word. Samantha also feels lucky to have the opportunity to share her experiences with so many during her time here. Thank you, Samantha.
So this poem when I submitted it, it was really personal and it was very like historical and narrative. But like Gloria Steinem says, the personal is political, so now it's a little bit more political than personal. So I live in the house of a murdered girl. The one that this week is about, the bench on our lawn, the affair gone wrong. Of course, this cosmic joke led me here to this place. Once it's happened to you, you're cursed to relive it the rest of your days. Not just flashbacks, PTSD. You don't believe me? Look it up. See what the stats say. Once it's happened once, it's increasingly likely. So of course I'm on this porch, her porch, our porch, at this party that I'm throwing for strangers unknowing that the girl whose story they're telling as a ghost story could be, is me, was me. Was all of us who know the slimy chair, the twisted guts, the breathlessness, full of fear, praying for luck. That our exes won't go as far as hers did. That there will be no bullets in either of us. That we live through every night without recourse for rejection. But you laugh, look for bullet holes in my actual house. My stomach sinks. Why didn't they tell me? Is this how it would be if she'd have succeeded if I died on my porch? If my life was superseded by her desire to keep me all to herself? Is this how it would be if I was the murdered girl and she was me? You know, they didn't believe me, though this is all a true story. Is it because I'm big? Is size a requisite to feel pain? Does my long hair make up for it, though? My femininity make you feel sorry for me? Or does it just make my black eye a cat fight? Good for you to holler at. Take off your shirt and reveal what? Cracked ribs? Is my bra still sexy with all of these bruises? She died right where we stand. Is that funny to you? How her mother still cries 4 years or for life? You can't scrub out that stain. Those of us who've lived through it and survived the pain, we've got it forever, this unwanted gain. This man's jealousy caused it, entitlement to love, and his ideal embodiment of it. She wasn't lucky, trust me. When you fall from the pedestal, the precipice on which you stood is ugly. You don't break the fall, they break you. They try to take it all for themselves. This violence is selfishness. Masquerading as she asked for this. Fueled by sex cells. I'm a commodity. You can consume me. You have a right to consume me. And take from me through any means what you need. Be it fists or roofies lying on the couch passed out, our friends will say, "Looked like you had fun last night," because he had a right to my body. Supply your demands. Your right to have sex. This is what we call rape culture. But you think that we're screaming wolf. It gnaws at us the same, but the teeth are sold as love. We are told that we are lucky. Someone wants us so badly, enough to risk anything, even our lives. It is so easy when it's not your story to ignore it, or blissfully ignore it. Easy to ignore that no matter how many times I told her I loved her, she was enough. Please don't do this. I tried to hold her close enough not to want to die. It won't be enough. And she'll turn on me, and I'll go back to the party with bite marks and scuffed knees and 4 years ahead of the same thing. We fall down, we burn down, we leave behind only clouds of smoke. Who's choking now, gagging on tragedy, stuck in their throats like her hands around mine, thinking of all of the times they didn't care. All the actions never taken, all the help they never gave. Of the murdered girl whose living room, my living room, became her first grave. Yet here we are still consuming tragedy as entertainment. I hope you feel it. I hope you do something about it. If I had died, someone would have had to live in my house. My mother would have had to remember daily, unable to save me. For those of us living it, it never goes away. Perpetual horror story in our veins. I live in the house of a murdered girl, but selfishly, the ghosts I see are ghosts of the me that could have been.
Lastly, it is an absolute pleasure to welcome Jessie Borsmo-Shavid. You met her once already tonight. Jessie is also a co-chair of the feminist-led activist movement for power, and of course works at the Feminist Position office here on campus. She is in her third year at U of I. She advocates for social justice through art, performance, and words. Please welcome Jessie.
They have some things in common, like the ability to bleed memories internally. They pop up purple and swollen with the unwillingness to smile back at older men. disregarding the fact that there are expectations of a woman and a smile as being one of them. The wounds clot when I click my pen, my heels in a room full of strangers, fighting every urge to breathe unsteadily by gripping anything that can hold me down. I lick my scar that tastes of metallic when swallowing the highest dose of my little white pill every evening before bed. I can't forget them. This is what it comes down to. I seem to shift crooked in my chairs when I forget to take them the night before. 2 days without them, I find myself mending, reopening scars rather than skin. All 3 days, I am cross-eyed, looking for anything that hurts, that feels good. There is no difference. 4 days, and I am lapping up desperation, anxiety by the bowlfuls. I am spinning in circles, and I swear to God, I just saw his face. 5 days. He is touching me in my sleep yet again, and all I want to do is cry a lung, thank you very much. Do not touch me. Do not look at me. Do not judge my story. I can see your wrinkling face in pity. Knock it off. If I forget to take my little white happy pills, I am not only a faceless woman, I am that young girl with chunky black braids just trying to stop the bleeding. So with that, let me introduce myself. Hi, my name is Jessie. I was molested and raped by my foster brother for 2 years. But those 2 years, I was beaten, neglected, and verbally abused by my parents. The result? PTSD, anxiety, depression, and survivor's guilt. My goals? To give people strength, love, and courage through my voice. I want you to know that I am not a victim. I am a survivor, just like you.
So again, you're listening to Yin Radio. My name is Tara Howe. And thus far, we've been talking about what the University of Idaho has done this past week in terms of their safety week on campus, which is motivated towards stopping sexual assault and violence of all forms. And it was a very comprehensive week. I'm just featuring two of the events here and some interviews on this show. But if you do get a chance to look into it, it's quite amazing what they have put together in order to orient students into the realities, right, of life in a changing environment. So up next, I have an interview with Amber Morchek, a PhD student from WSU. And this was recorded earlier this week. Thankfully, she was willing to speak with me late one evening in order to get this all set up for today. So on this interview, I'll have her introduce herself. And this, again, is Amber Morchek on Yin Radio.
Amber, welcome to Yin Radio. Do you want to tell me a little bit about what you're studying at WSU?
Sure. I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology. And a lot of the research and work that I do specifically is on sexual violence. My dissertation is actually on sexual violence, rape culture, and pornography. So it really sort of ties into our conversation today pretty well.
Absolutely. How long have you been working at WSU?
I got here to WSU in 2011. I actually got my master's degree in criminal justice in New York. So I'm actually from New York originally and moved to Duluth in 2011. But yeah, I started here and I'm loving it and I'm loving the people that I'm working with. It's been really great.
Good. Okay. So can you tell me a little bit more about your, maybe more both the personal and professional involvement in going to events like Take Back the Night and the Hunting Ground and whatever perspective you want to offer?
On specifically those events?
Yep.
I've been involved with Take Back the Night at WSU specifically for the past couple of years, and of course I plan to attend in October this year. This was my first time at the University of Idaho's Take Back the Night event, and I actually hadn't seen the Hunting Ground yet. So it was a really, really great event. I was jazzed to see the students come out in droves to support it, especially Greek students were wearing their letters and such. But, yeah, I've been involved for a while, and it was nice to see a march with just so many supportive people at it, as well as at the Hunting Ground, where I saw all the administrators, all the students, just a big supportive community. So it was quite empowering for me doing the work that I do, seeing everyone at U of I. So involved.
Good. Good. I'm glad to hear that, actually. You know, it seems that way to me, having been in the area for a while, that our communities in general are very involved. But it was interesting being at the Hunting Ground and hearing the administrative support and comparing to what we were seeing in the film. And, you know, I really had the sense that we were more involved, generally speaking. But that was, you know, that's coming from one personal opinion without a lot of outside knowledge. Do you think that's the case in terms of the...
Oh, no. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but yeah, I'm super jazzed about this, because when I went to this event, you know, I really got a sense that, quite honestly, I feel profoundly lucky to be engaged in this work on the Palouse, because I'm surrounded by so many people who are passionate, much like I am. They're really fighting injustice and oppression and, you know, working to end sexual violence in a tireless fashion. And, you know, I don't know. Of course, I can't speak to other areas, but I can't necessarily see it being so, people being so involved in the community in other places. I mean, we saw that in the movie The Hunting Ground, where there was, you know, certain universities who weren't stepping up to the plate in terms of dealing with interpersonal violence, but that is the opposite of what I saw at the U of I event. I just saw so many administrators, so many students, and so many supportive people in the community who want to make sure that these issues aren't problematic in the future.
Right. Good. Good. I'm glad hearing you say that with all your background. It's nice to hear that reinforcement. Can you tell us a little bit about what drew you into this area of study?
Oh, sure. So when I first started in undergrad, my motivation was largely to be in psychology and to be in the helping profession, but I sort of switched over to criminal justice just based on some of the more topical areas of focus. But really why I'm passionate about, you know, dealing with interpersonal violence and, you know, dispelling rape culture and, you know, really looking at these issues is because I've been impacted by violence. You know, I myself am a survivor of interpersonal violence. I have too many friends who've been impacted by this. And, you know, if I can use, I guess if I can use my education as a platform to break the silence around sexual violence, to empower victims, and to help change culture, that's what I'll do. Because, I've just had so many people in my life who've been impacted, and I don't want that to happen anymore. I don't want anyone else to have, you know, droves of friends who've been impacted by violence. I want to work myself out of a job, quite frankly.
Absolutely. I love it. What about that move? That's interesting. I think your move from looking at the psychological elements into the more structural elements, was it a defining moment? You describe it ambiguously, so I'm not sure if there was a defining moment or just that really the topical elements were what switched you into the structural involvement, by which I mean the criminal justice piece of it.
You know, I think it was just more of the topical stuff at the time. When I was getting my master's degree, I had the option to go into mental health counseling for my master's, and I just happened to apply to this criminal justice program, and it just really fit, and just the pieces clicked into place. And, you know, I really didn't get passionate necessarily about specifically sexual violence until, I would say, 2008, 2009, while I was getting my master's degree, but then it really took off. I've always been interested in helping people. This just, you know, now happens to be the realm in which I get to do so.
Right. Can you tell me a little bit more about that in terms of being a woman? And what I'm really thinking here is historically we've seen so many women in the more one-to-one helping professions, you know, being the social workers and being on these front lines of all that, which is incredibly necessary, incredibly wonderful, right? But then we haven't seen a lot of women until this last little while start coming into the structures that create the laws, the structures that, you know, put all the dynamics into place. So at this point, do you feel, are you glad that's where you're at? Does it feel like you can make more difference there? Are you just aware of those differences? I just wonder what you have to say to that coming from that perspective.
Sure. I can speak to that a bit in terms of having women in the field and positions like mine where we are trying to involve ourselves in more larger cultural shifts as opposed to one-on-one social work or advocacy or what have you. You know, I think that's really what's driving a lot of the push towards ending sexual violence, not only on college campuses, but in communities, and really focusing on things like domestic violence and stalking. Having women in these positions of power, so to speak, are really driving all of this legislation and policy change and conversation around this issue. Because whether or not, you know, we recognize it in every single instance, women are profoundly impacted by violence. Women of all colors, women of all identities, we're all affected by men's violence. So it's important for us to be sort of the focal point of this movement. And I've really seen that happen. And I think myself as a woman, you know, I find it very empowering to be in the field with other women who are doing the same exact thing or, you know, striving towards the same goals.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what about then as well with the changing culture with men themselves? Like, we definitely saw a lot of support from certain men at these events, and it seems like there are definitely increasing numbers of men coming out to support. Can you comment to some of those changes, say, in the past 10 years or what you're noticing on that front?
Sure. Even in my own personal experience, I've noticed many more men becoming allies within the sort of fight to end violence against women. We actually, on campus, on WSU campus, we have this group called Men for Social Change, and they're really great. They've been dealing specifically with getting men involved, you know, to end violence in all its forms, and that's an undergrad movement on the WSU campus. But, you know, I've been seeing more of these little, you know, pockets of men who've been allies, who are, you know, helping to reach other men, who are helping to move this movement forward. You know, what's unfortunate about it is, you know, at this time, given some of the cultural norms, it can be difficult to reach some men. But I think over the past 10 years, we've done a great job at making inroads into getting a lot of people identified as male as allies. We've been framing the issue differently, really framing it as a leadership sort of issue, especially around bystander intervention and personalizing it. For many men. So we just have seen a lot more men being involved with this fight. And we saw that at U of I. I mean, I saw that at Take Back Tonight. There were just so many helpful people there, men and women included. But it was great to see specifically fraternity men really reach out and try to, you know, end this violence.
That was a big part. I actually have noticed in walking around the U of I campus in the last couple of days, signs I hadn't noticed before, just showing that they are supportive of anti-hazing and that they're, signs I've never seen go up at the fraternities before. And I thought that was interesting that they would advertise publicly that it's, you know, some of these traditional elements of, you know, past brotherhood, initiation rite type things are not what they're promoting.
Right. Yeah, and I don't want to, like, sugarcoat it by any stretch of the imagination. Of course, we have these male peer groups who, you know, do have these hyper-masculine elements and who are very secretive and who, you know, do consume alcohol, and there's all these inherent, you know, negative behaviors that are elicited from that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as you were just saying, when we were walking around U of I, there's signs people are, you know, there's signs that the time is changing, especially within these groups.
How do you, just on a personal level at this point, how do you feel in terms, and I know so many factors play in, right, including age and location, but in terms of being able to walk on campus, in terms of being able to walk at night, in terms of being able to be a professional and just do your job, you know, do you feel like things have also shifted significantly for you so that you feel we are in a better climate? I know not perfect, but...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's part and parcel to being on the produce and having so many supports in this area. You know, I don't necessarily know whether I feel as supportive in the work that I do, especially, you know, around pornography and ending rape culture and so on, at maybe other institutions or in other communities. But on the produce, I feel 100% comfortable and 100% empowered to do the work that I do. I have just so many allies that I can turn to and work with. You'll be interviewing one. Her name's Virginia Sloan. She's great over at U of I. Lisa and Becca at the Women's Center. People on my campus. Just so many feminist allies that just make it so easy to do this work in the Palouse. Certainly there are days when it's discouraging to a certain extent doing programming. But after I went to the U of I event, I was talking to Virginia about this. I felt reinvigorated to continue to do this work, to remain passionate. And even if I have a bad day, there's people around me who I reach out to sort of pull me out of that. And the U of I event, I can tell you, I was not having a great week until I got to those events and saw all the support. And I was so happy. So yeah, I feel 100% supportive, especially in this area with the work that I do.
Good. I'm really glad to hear that on multiple fronts.
Yeah.
It actually, it makes me think that I want to ask you about the feeling of and the actual impacts then of being silenced. So times when you have felt that you have to modify how you speak or downplay perhaps what you're studying, ways that you've basically had to change in order not to be the recipient of violence on all forms, right?
Yeah, the only way I've ever felt silenced, I think, was really self-imposed for me, and that was part and parcel to the victimizations that I've experienced. It wasn't necessarily external. I just felt like I wasn't in a place to disclose what had happened. Reflecting back on those times now, I know I was surrounded by a supportive group of people who would have been very receptive to listening to me and supporting me. But really, any silence that I've sort of incurred is self-imposed.
Sure. I can appreciate that. I often wonder when women say it's self-imposed, and I know there's no measurement on this, obviously.
Sure.
But really, when we talk about systemic violence of all sorts, just the amount of silence women sure have self-imposed in this sense, but over the years, because collectively the silencing has been so strong. There's oftentimes I've found in all the work I've done as well that depending on the situation, I'll feel more open. If I am verbally attacked, I might close back down for a while. So there's a sort of ebb and flow. But always coming back to the notion of how quickly attacks will come for speaking what I always felt was quite benign factors. Perhaps because we all are working, we should have equal pay. Simple things. Perhaps women of all races should be respected,
No, and I get that, yeah, and I'm not trying to sanitize that in any way, shape, or form, because certainly there are certain areas, let's say, around the Palouse who would be less receptive to even some of the language that you see used, or even, like you said, the idea that women should have equal pay. I guess I'm not the type of person to back down in those situations unless I felt like physically threatened. But there have certainly been times when I can tell that the message I'm trying to send is not being received whatsoever. And that's where I can sort of get discouraged to a certain extent, but that I don't want that to stop me at all by speaking my truth. So.
Good. That's really nice to hear, and seems to be an increasing story with the younger generations coming up, which has been nice. I really find that nice to see. It feels like younger women are recognizing more of a place. And I love, of course, because we're crossing all these boundaries with gender and opening everything up so we don't have these dichotomies, just the fact that people from all walks of life are able to speak from who they are now as opposed to keeping that closed down. This is a huge shift, even in this last 10 years specifically. Last 2 years with so much coming out. So that is really nice to hear. And I don't want to dredge up things that have been. And so that, I think when you put it that way, it just reminds me also even some of the changes that have been happening generationally in this So within that, then, I had wanted to ask you, which you're already alluding to, but with the Green Dot program and all the bystander awareness. And I know Virginia's done such amazing work with the program here at the UI, and from what it appears from the outside, looking in, it's just had amazing success. And so I had wanted to ask you specifically, too, what your impression of that was.
at WSU, we have the Green Dot program as well. I'm actually one of the three people. I work in violence prevention programs on our campus as well as a graduate assistant. So there's three of us in the office who do Green Dot facilitations. And I've seen quite a shift in students' perspective around violence after we do these trainings. I really feel like Green Dot pushes to change the culture because obviously we both recognize that our culture, violence is culturally permissive in American culture and Western culture. So we're really changing the dynamic around that. And we're forcing students almost through their training to think critically about their behavior and the behavior of others, and then giving them the tools and tips and tricks to use when they are out and about on campus to really engage and to stop violence before it starts, right? Because a lot of our, a lot of the federal mandates that are coming down, they're very reactive, and the Green Dot program is very proactive. We get emails from students quite often, you know, regaling us with stories about how someone who was Green Dot trained helped them in some way, shape, or form, and it's been really profound. And a lot of the research, you know, that's recently come out has indicated that there's been statistically significant drops in violence on campuses as a result of bystander intervention and specifically Green Dot.
That is so excellent to hear.
Yeah.
Do you feel like then that that is really the more positive direction of flow, then that it'll be from these cultural changes that we make the legal and institutional changes that are still needed?
Can you rephrase for me?
Do you think it, you know, it's we so often come from the perspective it has to be this top-down element, except in women's groups where obviously it's always been sort of this grassroots approach, but it seems to me that the institutional changes that have been taking place are, I guess they're going back and forth, right, between the cultural change and accompanying institutional changes. And what I'm thinking of specifically was in the film, the two women that were really driving this particular movement to mobilize things on their campus, and then as they started witnessing the more national trend, they used the Title IX because it was what was available, but it still seemed like a, you know, it was like a really big shoe for something that, you know, needed something much smaller. That, you know, they had to choose what was there, and yet there could have been other institutional things in place.
Yeah, I think those two things work in tandem, these national pushes and then these grassroots efforts like what we saw in the hunting grounds. You know, if they weren't working in tandem, I don't think that we would have the positive effects, you know, that we're seeing today when these grassroots efforts, like the two women in the film who were using Title IX, and then we have all these changes to institutional response, you know, we're always working together. It's really driven big shifts in how universities and communities respond to violence. And then, again, how students perceive the violence, report the violence, conceptualize it.
Absolutely. Thank you. I look through your succinctness and wonderful academic voice to be able to speak this more clearly for our listeners. So thank you.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow Pullman, and we are listening to an interview with Amber Morchek, a PhD student at WSU and assistant in the violence prevention programs. And we will head right on back in.
So what else then from the film, from your experience, from all of this, what are you noticing or what are you thinking that still has yet to be worked on? What are some of the next steps maybe that are already being taken or that you see we could be taking locally and then more nationally as well?
Yeah, nationally, I think that, you know, it's really great that we're having all of these pushes towards programming for students on campuses and education and all of that. But we also need to make sure the funding is there. You know, I can only speak to WSU and our office, violence prevention. I mean, there's only two full-time staff, and then they have, you know, me as a grad assistant. So that's not necessarily enough people to do all of the mandatory education, you know, that we have to do for students and that we love doing. But, you know, if there's only two full-time staff ties, it makes it very difficult and very draining on the people who are doing the work. So, you know, the old adage, you can throw some money at it. That would be helpful, actually.
Yeah.
just to get more staff in there. And we could do, quite honestly, much more. I feel like we're doing a lot at WSU, but again, having some extra funding, we could make things so much better and just do a lot more programming and reach a lot more students.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a possibility with the changes you're seeing and with the elements working in tandem now? Do you feel like there's more possibility than before?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that with all of these sort of the grassroots, the national level, everything working together, I certainly think as the years go on, there will be, many more opportunities to get more staff involved, to work collaboratively across campuses, and get everyone on the same page. And again, we're already starting that, getting that ball rolling now. So I look forward to the future to see where these changes evolve to.
Absolutely. That's so nice. It is so nice to hear in your voice that hope, which is so different than not very long ago when I think it felt in most of these discussions that the understanding was there and the momentum on the larger scale was not. So just this much shift in a relatively short time. I've spoken to women, who were in movements in the 50s who would say it's taken forever, of course, but on a, then there is some of that.
Yeah.
But in this, in still a relatively short period over this last 10 years, it just seems things have started to skyrocket. So, what do you find now then, with all your expertise, what are we missing? Is there anything that you feel like we're not focusing on beyond the money, which quite frankly,
sure.
That is huge, right? So the money is
right.
What allows for the mobilization. But anything else that we're not looking at or I'm not addressing in my questions to you or was not addressed in the panel discussion?
I think it's important to not only look at individual instances of violence and sort of take it from that perspective, but a lot of the research that I do is on rape culture, and I think it is important to understand the dynamics therein. Of course, rape culture normalizes, justifies, lyricizes, and excuses violence specifically against women, and these forms or cultural norms are integrated at all levels of society, and I think if we try to focus a bit more on dealing with that in whatever way that we can, at least just recognizing it. It normalizes violence in our culture, it emancipates perpetrators, and it adversely impacts victims when we have a culture that we live in that is supportive of sexual violence, that finds it to be normative. Trying to get the word out there about those elements, I think, would be helpful. And I'm trying to do that with my work, and I know my colleagues are as well. But that's, again, sort of a burgeoning sort of front at this point in time, too. But, again, I'm hopeful for where that will take us.
Do you have any writings out there, Amber, right now that speak to that?
Personally?
Mm-hmm.
Publication? Yeah, I wrote two pieces. They're actually published in the Sexual Assault Report. That goes out to prevention experts and enforcement, treatment teams, all of that. One of them was on rape culture and the connection to sexual violence, and then I did a follow-up piece that they then published on specifically on pornography and how that normalizes violence against women and how we don't talk about that. That's a huge industry, and how we don't chat about that enough as being, not a linear cause to violence against women, but certainly creating a culture where violence against women is normative.
Absolutely. When you're talking about it being normative, I come back to my initial studies were in anthropology, and it was always the most deeply held tenets of a society, the central tenets that were the least questioned, being the most embedded. And it sounds essentially, if I was to take anthropological terms, that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah, absolutely. One example always comes to mind for me when someone asks me to identify what rape culture looks like. If they're really questioning me, they don't understand it, or maybe they're even, being confrontational with me. I think of something like, we use terms to describe sexual activity that have a violent connotation, and we do so flippantly. Like, beat it up, hit it, murder it, pound, slam, smash, tear it up, all of these words that are inherently aggressive and violent, we use them so flippantly to describe sexual activity. And, you know, when I work with students and I make that connection, they look at me and the light bulb goes on, right? Because it's so ingrained, like you said, that they don't even recognize that we associate violence with sex in just even the most seemingly trivial ways, like through language. So, yeah, I think it's important to talk about things like that. And when I talk to students, the light bulb goes off, and I like to see that.
Absolutely. And your approach, you're so well able, I think, to speak so clearly to things and in looking. Yeah, no, it's wonderful. And being able to approach it from, which sounds funny to say on one side, but I mean the factual, the academic approach, taking all this information and being able to put it out there. I mean, I think it's hard when you're up against cognitive dissonance is what it sounds like. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people, yeah. Right? So... no, your ability to speak to it that way is so foundational to making change. So I think you're definitely, obviously that's an asset. let's see, anything else? I don't want to keep you much longer here. But I could talk to you for hours on this. So thank you so much.
I know, right?
For being here. Yes.
I do want to add one other thing.
Yes.
You know, you had alluded to chatting about how I see these events like Tick Raconite and the hunting ground impacting women. And I actually saw that personally in the last few events that I attended through U of I. I have friends who, you know, chatted with me after some of these events that, you know, that really put some of the things that I've experienced in perspective. So thank you for inviting me to that. I think that those of us who work in the field, we often forget that there are people who aren't immersed in the field of sexual violence every day. You know, they don't wake up thinking about this stuff like I do, you know. So when I have friends who go to these events who, you know, may not typically be inclined to go to, let's say, Take Back the Night, and then they go, they experience it, they hear the stories of others, I see how impacted they are. And it just makes me so, not happy that they necessarily connected it to their own victimization, but that they felt comfortable enough now to come forward, or that they put the connection together, or, you know, they felt like maybe I was a safe space for them to disclose that. So I can tell you firsthand, events like Take Back the Night, watching the hunting grounds, you know, having rallies and marches and using Green Dot, these are personally impacting people on the ground, and I've seen it, and I'm glad that it's happening.
That's an excellent point and an excellent reminder. Like you said, when you're so immersed in working with these issues from whatever direction you're coming from, so I'll forget that as well. And just you saying that, is such a good reminder for all of us for keeping that in the institution that way as well. Even in the film, you know, they're talking about how every 4 years, every new group of students coming through, you know, it's just re-beginning, and to have these events that continue to maintain that. Of course, in my world of writing, you know, the impact of story and our stories on our consciousness and our ability to live, all of this really resonates. So I really appreciate you saying that in that way. Gosh, thank you so much.
No problem. I totally appreciate you having me. It's been a great experience. I'm glad I could chat with you. And even having this conversation has, you know, lit another fire in me to continue to do the work that I do. So I appreciate your time.
Amber, thanks again so much, and I'll talk to you soon.
That was Amber Morchek, a PhD student at WSU and also working in the violence prevention programs. We interviewed earlier this week by phone, and really, really appreciate her being on air and bringing that information to you. What I wanted to do, and again, I mentioned earlier, I'm going to put this up on... up on the website, which is the Yin Radio blog at WordPress. But I'm going to just give you a list of some of the publications that Amber's been a part of and some other publications that she listed for me in an email. That way you've got it on air. And then again, as I mentioned, you can find that probably later this evening. I'll be able to get this up on the website as well. So she wrote The Synergistic Connection Between Sexual Violence and Rape Culture. This is part of the Sexual Assault Report. This is March-April 2015. Also pornography, the mass production of sexual violence in the sexual assault report, and this is May and June of 2015. And then with D.A. Makin, she has, and I'm not sure if this is X views or 10 views and counting, so 10 views and counting or X views and counting, interest in rape-oriented pornography as gendered microaggression in the Journal of Interpersonal Violence. And this date is 2015. Also with D.A. Makin, we have The Dark Side of Internet Searches, a Macro-Level Assessment of Rape Culture, and this is the International Journal of Cybercriminology. And I had asked for some other resources as well that might be more palatable, so those are more academic resources and other voices that put it out to all of our masses as we need it to be well understood. There is a book by Kay Harding called Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It, and also by Jay Krakauer, and that's K-R-A-K-A-U-E-R, Rape in the Justice System in a College Town, and that is Penguin Random House Publishing. So again, I just have to give a big thank you to Amber Morchek for interviewing with me earlier this week so that we could put together this broadcast. That was Deshai Williams with the song No More. You've been listening to Yin Radio. Today we're talking about sexual assault, specifically on campus, and the ways in which our communities have been dealing with this. Last week was Safety Week at the University of Idaho, and it was a really comprehensive week geared towards educating and empowering its students. And two of the events that were hosted, one was the Take Back the Night walk and march and rally, I should call it. And we listened earlier to the spoken word of three student activists, Mimi Price, Samantha Hansen, and Jesse Forsmo Shadid. And I think, just like this, the Shai Williams songs show that this is such an important place that we can speak, that we can use our voice to speak to these issues. Earlier we had an interview with Amber Morchek, and coming up here soon, I'm going to air an interview I did with Virginia Solon, who's the works in the Dean's Office at the University of Idaho and is the coordinator for violence prevention programs. What I wanted to let you know, though, is unfortunately the second part of our video or our audio, I'm sorry, was corrupted. I tease my sons, we have a ghost in our house, but everything worked just fine until I went to pull the second part of the file. And of course, that's a loss, because Virginia is an incredible speaker. And so I do have the first part of our interview, which I'll play here in a minute. But what was lost on the second part of the interview is her speaking specifically to the importance and the revolutionary change of the bystander prevention programs. And that is a big part of what I wanted to do in this broadcast, was to you know, give you a little more awareness of this issue as a whole, and feature voices of women around our area who are speaking to this, but also let you know why and how important the violence, the bystander programs are. This is, as Virginia mentioned in the part of the interview you won't get to hear, one of the most major changes we've seen in the last 40 years. And so, you know, for all this effort that's been put into violence prevention, all these different things that have been tried, so much has focused on, you know, either the victim, survivor, or the perpetrator. And what we haven't done is come back in and change what bystanders can do in order to step in safe and effective ways to create distraction. And then in what this is doing is changing the culture itself of violence. So when we've had, most of us obviously, not feeling like we can do anything about it, that's that helpless feeling that, you know, things need to change, you know, you want to do something and you don't know what you can do or how to do it. And so the bystander programs are changing that. They're giving people tools, and it's been a very, very, very successful program. And so our local program, both at WSU and the U of I, is called Green Dot, and this is based off of a national program with extensive training and really, really interesting studies to support it. So what I'm going to do before we get into Virginia's interview is to read to you from the Green Dot website, that so you can have a better understanding, since we're going to be missing that part of it. And this website that I'm looking at here is called livingthegreendot.com. Living, L-I-V-I-N-G, the, T-H-E, green, as in the color, G-R-E-E-N, dot, D-O-T. So if you look up Living the Green Dot, you'll find this information as well. But let me just give you a little bit of background before we go ahead and listen to what Virginia had to tell us about the program and about the work she's been doing at the University of Idaho. So from the website: given the extraordinary human cost of failure, we must inform every aspect of what we do with the most current science, then divest personal ego and scrutinize our work with objectivity and scientific rigor, course correcting each step of the way. The Green Dot curriculum is informed by concepts and lessons learned from bodies of research and theory across disciplines including violence against women, diffusion of innovation, public health, social networking, psychology, communications, bystander dynamics, perpetration, and marketing advertising. Additionally, since the foundation of Green Dot is built upon the necessity of achieving a critical mass of individuals willing to engage in new behaviors, it is important that we strive to recognize and address anything within our efforts that might be limiting engagement, including historical obstacles in the field of violence prevention and professional and personal obstacles we all face. Finally, in contrast to historical approaches to violence prevention that have focused on victims and perpetrators, the Green Dot strategy is predicated on the belief that individual safety is a community responsibility, and shift the lens away from victims, perpetrators, and onto bystanders. The overarching goal is to mobilize a force of engaged and proactive bystanders. Visualize for a moment that unforgettable image of small red dots spreading across a computer-generated map of the U.S., symbolizing the spread of some terrible epidemic. Each tiny red dot representing an individual case. With disturbing speed, the three or four single dots multiply and spread until the whole map emits a red glow composed of a zillion tiny dots. Now imagine for a moment a map of your own campus, military base, community, state, or neighborhood. Each red dot on this map represents an act of power-based personal violence, partner violence, sexual violence, stalking, bullying, child abuse, or elder abuse, or a choice to tolerate, justify, or perpetuate this violence. A red dot is a rape, a red dot is a hit, a red dot is a threat. A red dot is an individual choice to do nothing in the face of a potentially high-risk situation. Power-based personal violence is not a huge, solid mass that can simply be removed with one swift action or policy. Rather, it is the accumulation of individual decisions, moments, values, and actions made by the men and women from every corner of our world. It's hard to know exactly how many red dots are on our map at any given moment, but we do know there have been enough red dots to create a culture that promotes bystander inaction and sustains a rate of nearly a quarter of women becoming victims of violence during their lifetimes, and an untold number of men experiencing similar trauma. Now, imagine adding a green dot in the middle of all those red dots on your map. A green dot is any behavior, choice, word, or attitude that promotes safety for all our citizens and communicates utter intolerance for violence. A green dot is pulling a friend out of a high-risk situation. A green dot is donating a few dollars to your local service provider. A green dot is displaying an awareness poster in your room or office. A green dot is putting a green dot message on your Facebook page. A green dot is striking up a conversation with a friend or family member about how much this issue matters to you. A green dot is simply your individual choice at any given moment to make our world safer. How many green dots will it take to begin reducing power-based personal violence? How many of us need to add 2 or 3 or 7 or 50 dots to this map to begin to make a difference and begin to outnumber and displace those red dots? We cannot know the exact number, but we do know this. If most of us choose inaction, if most of us choose to close our eyes to this issue, if most of us choose apathy and indifference, then the red dots stand. If we do not begin replacing moments of violence with moments of support and safety, then we will surely continue to have More than 1 in 4 women and countless men become victims of violence. That is not okay and must not be okay with any of us. This, again, I'm reading directly from the Green Dot website. That's Living the Green Dot. You can look up online. And this in reference to the fact that these are the programs that are in place here locally at the University of Idaho and WSU that are making significant change in terms of violence prevention on campus. And after watching this week, The Hunting Ground, which really raised questions about systemic support of violence by inaction, essentially, or even sort of filibustering the ability of students to go forward and prosecute in sexual assault cases, the University of Idaho, and from what Amber Morchek says as well, obviously at WSU, and I apologize, this is only because we've had the U of I here speaking to this last week, you know, are ahead of the curve, absolutely, in dealing with this. And there's more yet to be done, but there are incredible groups working towards the eradication of violence in our community as a whole and on campus. So what we're going to go to next is an interview that I did again earlier this week with Virginia Solon, the violence prevention coordinator at the University of Idaho. And it does get cut off partway through again, as I said, because we had some corrupted data files, for which I apologize.
I'm Virginia Solon, and I'm the Violence Prevention Programs Coordinator at the University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho, obviously. And I've been there for 3 years in that capacity. Before that, I worked at the Women's Center, and before that, as a responder to sexual assault and other forms of violence in our community and on campus through Alternatives to Violence with our victim advocacy provider. So I bring a lot of different experience in this particular region to the violence prevention work that I'm doing. And what I am focusing on and in the third year of is bystander intervention. And that's best practices. That's all the research coming out of Washington and really globally in terms of prevention, that motivating young people to take action and to learn skills in how they can intervene in a variety of situations where someone might be at risk, but be able to do so in their comfort zone safely and comfortably, while also internalizing this cultural message of individual and collective responsibility and everybody having a role to play. That's the main thrust of my programming at UI, even though I have some other stuff that I do as well, including a speakers bureau in the course of building various months through activist projects that students take on and things like that. So Green Dot is the leading program in bystander intervention. It's out of the University of Kentucky. And here at the University of Idaho, we have Vandal Green Dot. And I know that over at WSU, they've also funded Green Dot. They're 1 year ahead of us on that. And we both find it to be very successful. But we've trained almost 400 students in the 8-hour bystander intervention strategies workshop and reached over 4,000 in the 1-hour to 3-hour overview presentations. And that includes all of our athletes and all of our incoming Greek students, as well as our resident assistants and orientation leaders, and then a variety of other students, because they can all sign up. Mm-hmm. So I know that that's a lot I just threw at you, but that's generally what I do. And so as that being my area of responsibility, I chair the Safety Week that we have each year. It's in its fourth year now at University of Idaho. And, it's third year. It began in 2012 after the 2011 homicide of graduate student Katie Benoy, who was murdered by her psychology professor, whom she had formerly dated. So as part of our agreement, and out of a lot of discussions with Katie's family on how they would like to bring something positive out of that tragedy, that something that could also be Katie's legacy, something that she would really want to come out of all of this, we came up with Safety Week, which would be always within the first 2 weeks of school, because the first 6 weeks are known to be the most high risk for all students, but that the majority of sex assaults tend to occur in that first 6 weeks. So with the idea of we can all work together and provide a lot of dynamic, interactive programming for students on a wide range of topics, but always under the philosophy of I got your back is our community cultural standards motto, I got your back, which is basically a saying just looking out for each other. It's kind of a repackaging of the golden rule, if you will, and that's why Safety Week this year was named the 2015 Safety Week and the Katie Benoit Safety Forum, which was a particular event. So Safety Week, for example, this year included programming specific from our LGBTQA office on suicide prevention, other suicide prevention, drug and alcohol screenings and assessments and interventions, the launching of that alcohol program's Red Watch Bike Intervention campaign. We had a bicultural, really dynamic and well-attended discussion entitled What Your Mother Never Told You, which was sponsored by the Women's Center and the Multicultural Center, exploring the various intersection of culture and relationships in new environments, in particular at UI, new college environment, what that looks like in regard to prevention when it comes to power-based violence. And when I say that, I'm talking about anything from harassment, verbal harassment based on someone's perceived gender identity or sexuality preferences, all the way through to race and religion, going up to sexual assault, general assault, physical assault, dating, violence, stalking, homicide, and of course rape. So we also had Green Dot Booster sessions for students who've attended other sessions to come get together and dissect what's worked and hasn't in the months prior and get to know each other as well. We had also, of course, Take Back the Night on Thursday night, which is a real grassroots activism event that goes back many years, at least 15 years, I think. I'm not sure on that, but a long time at the UI campus. And then Friday night, we finished Safety Week with the program out of my office, which is located in the Dean of Students office. And that was our screening at the Kenworthy in town as an opportunity for campus and community to come together for this vital discussion, a screening of Hunting Ground, which the critically acclaimed documentary that was released earlier this year that takes a really hard look at institutional, as in college and university, structural and procedural response and quashing of reporting and various different dynamics within that related to privilege and other things from athletics to Greeks and all those sorts of things that tend to be rooted in a lot of financial concerns. So that film says, hey, yes, we've got these people doing these bad behaviors and but at the same time, we have a bigger problem in that we have some institutional priorities that are really messed up that are allowing these sexual assaults and these other kinds of offenses to go unchecked. And we had a panel discussion afterwards that featured our new Dean of Students, Blaine Eccles, as well as our Human Rights, Access, and Inclusion Director and our Title IX investigators and our conduct officer to talk about what our policies and procedures are at UI and what a student could expect to hear feedback and questions from, and hopefully provide good responses to students and community members who want to know what that looks like, and especially within the context of the questions that the film raised. So we have a dynamic on after that is about 45 minutes in which we talk about everything from records following students as they go through the adjudication process to what kind of protections there are for victims and the kind of work we have to do ahead. And that was in the spirit of accountability and transparency to saying that, yes, you know, we, of course, we're not perfect, and obviously, just looking at Katie's experience alone, everybody has things that we wish we had done differently and that we could still do differently, and so we're working on that, and we just want people to know that we consider, unlike what seems to be the standard, at least what was profiled in the film, institutionally, of a culture more of avoidance, denial, and taking care of the public image, that our university, again, we may not be perfect, but we do operate in the spirit of really trying to provide a safe and accessible environment for all of our students. And if we find out that someone's been hurt or that someone's at risk, then we do everything possible to support the victim and to address whatever issues are surrounding the alleged perpetrator or perpetration as harassment. I think I'll stop there
and
answer to your question.
No, thank you so much, because that, well, and my impression in attending the film and discussion was that the University of Idaho is doing an excellent job, and even just in being a community member here and now attending the school, you know, that is my impression. And then when you know, it's always easy to, yes, and I love that it's a continual commitment to both do more and then I can learn from it. And so in speaking that it's not perfect, absolutely. But then when you watch that film and you look at what other places are doing, at least my impression was just, it's amazing then what the U of I has managed to accomplish in comparison, especially to what's going on out there. I was, in the time you and I have talked about this and in a lot of years of emphasizing this, I still did not have the complex understanding of what was going on institutionally, structurally, and that film really pointed that out so well, and so it just re-emphasized, I think, the work that you've been doing, the Women's Center been doing, that all these agencies collectively together in the U of I as an institution. So I've been pretty impressed, and that was one of my questions for you, was if you felt like you guys are ahead of the curve in that sense. And it sounds like yes.
I do, especially within the context of resources. So many of those universities that were profiled, like Stanford and Harvard and Notre Dame, they have an incredible wealth of resources in which they can investigate and prosecute and provide resources and connect people in all kinds of really wonderful ways that we don't. We have such a much smaller team because of our level of funding through the state, and of course, so much of what we do is tied to enrollment, and universities everywhere, residential ones, are struggling with enrollment as online and other options become, they're just doubling, tripling, whatever by the day, right? So, I think that we have gone through almost a complete administrative change since the experience we had with Katie Minoy, and I think that is an experience that we continue to build on and to also remind us, to ground us, and remind ourselves that this work is really important, that people's lives are at stake. So I think that's one of the things about being at a smaller university like ours, too, that it's a lot tougher, say, for example, for our president to just think of students who are sexual assault victims as collateral damage, right, for the greater good of the university, when you might pass them in the coffee shop or in the hallway, or have them as an intern in your office. So it's just a much more personal and up close sort of an experience for our students. So I think that's one of the reasons why that's just my guess, that's why the folks that I work with seem to be just so committed to each student as individual. You know, behind closed doors, you hear people talking about a case or about an issue we're having on campus with, say, hazing or something, and the thrust is always, like, what can we do for these students, and how can we make this a learning experience, and what do we need to do to make sure that we're being culturally sensitive, or is there some issue we're not thinking of because we just haven't gone there yet that we need to be aware of, and how can we come up with some other resource? So I think sometimes having less inspires more creativity and camaraderie, because you have to work together more, and so and then I think that bonds us more in our work.
Absolutely. And you are, I know you are incredibly committed and so knowledgeable, and everything that you give back, and from what you describe, and in talking to Amber, it does sound like everyone who's been drawn in to work in this field, in this area, institutionally here, that it is, like you say, so you're, you know, can be more creative with less resources, but then also you just have this amazing group of people so willing to commit and give time. So I just want to point that out, because I don't, you know, gosh, you think you know how much time people are giving to something, and then I will come see you in different occasions and really think of what's gone into that and realize that's just one, you know, of the thousands of things that you're doing. And it could be, you know, 10 full-time positions right there. And so it's really, really, yeah, which I know you're completely aware of.
Well, it's, you know, it's because of our students are so committed to these issues, and they just keep driving what we do. They're the ones who brought Green Dot to campus, and they're the ones who want to do everything from, you know, that's why the room is packed when the Women's Center does F-word live, and like Take Back the Night is so well attended. There's just this commitment from the students, I think, that really continues to energize us. And then, you know, speaking collaboratively, I mean, I keep saying this, but as an example, I have 11 Green Dot facilitators. You have to be a faculty or staff, and you have to go through a 4-day training. And I've got that many folks on campus that donate their time on a Saturday or a Sunday or an evening to do these training for our students on how they can prevent violence on the day-to-day and in their own spaces. And it just never ceases to amaze me how much they're willing to volunteer their own time and be really there when they're there. I mean, Green Dot involves people telling their personal stories and connections to violence, and just really that training demands that you just show up in every sense of the word. And it's always completely voluntary for students as well. We don't provide mandatory trainings, because that's just not the spirit of Green Dot. And we just have so many people who are willing to contribute beyond what they already do, which just tends to be a little bit too much. So I would want to definitely give a shout out to them. But I'd also like to mention that we're coming up for the Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and speaking of collaborations, we're going to be doing the Clothesline Project at UI, and we'll be working with HDP, and taking a lead on that is going to be our Black Student Union and our multicultural students, also working with my office, and my office is coordinating it, but also with our student government, ASUI, and the IFANUS student organization, and that's a project that's been going on for years. It's clotheslineproject.org if you want to learn more about it. But what we do is string clotheslines throughout campus in really visible high-traffic locations, and we string up on them T-shirts that students have come and painted or decorated or otherwise put their creative marks on in regard to their connection to any kind of violence statement about that. And then you connect those up with clothespins onto the clotheslines all over campus, and then they're just there for the whole month as this reminder of the very personal way in which everybody is connected to violence. There's not a person walking who hasn't experienced some form of power-based violence if they don't know someone who has, and at some point in our lives, it touches all of this, even just from the culture that we live in and how that limits us in so many ways. But that's going to be going on, and community members as well are going to be welcome to paint T-shirts and help us with that, and that's going to culminate in the homecoming weekend, the last weekend in October, and we'll have the exhibit over in that area as well. And then Gene Fisher, who is the Ada County, down in the Boise area, Ada County Special Prosecutor for Sexual Assault Crimes is working with the UI football team and athletics department. They're doing a video about taking a stand against power-based violence, and that's going to be shown at the homecoming game and, you know, in conjunction with the clothesline project and stuff, too. So that will be something really exciting, I think, coming up. That's going to have a lot of student voices and community voices in, as well as being pretty artsy and stuff, too. So, and if people want to know more about what we're doing, you can check us out on Facebook, Vandal Green Dot, and we're also on Twitter and Tumblr and Snapchat and Instagram. And we're going to be launching a new campaign in a few weeks, and we're going to be having a lot of stuff, auto plays and a bystander film festival, music festival, a lot of stuff coming up in the coming school year that's going to be celebrating the power of the bystander and the voice of the individual and the role that we all have to play in preventing violence, yeah, and finding our own integrity along those lines and where we stand and developing our voice and our power within to stand in a way in the world that makes us feel proud and in a way that we want to be remembered. So.
That's amazing, Virginia. Everything you say, every sentence that you're speaking, I just want to respond with all of these pieces, but I'm just going to respond by saying that's amazing. I mean, everything you just mentioned, the football team and that film, that element of bringing in the sports, these other sort of, you know, older brotherhoods of violence, that those are shifting
by shifting
the culture is amazing.
I think that it's Keith Edwards, Dr. Edwards, who was on our campus last year, who works a lot with issues around masculinity and with college men, and he said that we were going to see that we've reached a tipping point, that there are so many good men out there, and, for example, even in the NFL, so many good men that it's going to reach a point with all of the bad behavior that they were going to feel like enough is enough and that they were going to be moved to take action and be really vocal and proactive in dealing with violence and preventing it. And that's exactly what has happened. So many pro players have come out with their own programs, from the Seattle Quarterback's anti-bullying campaign, which he admits he used to be a bully, all the way through to this announcement made just a couple of weeks ago at the National Sexual Assault Conference in Los Angeles, and I was so excited when I found out that the National Football League has entered into a multi-million dollar deal with the prevention folks who have done all of this research around the fact that men's violence starts very, very young, as we know, you know, from all these kind of messed up messages they get about being men and this catch 22 that we put them in, and then if they go the athletic route, how...
Again, as I mentioned, I apologize. Virginia's interview was cut short when my computer decided to eat the rest of the digital information. But I do want to let you know that Virginia was a former host of Yin Radio and did this for, I believe it was 2 years, and an incredible, incredible work that she did with this. Excuse me. And so if you do a search of Yin Radio and the University of Idaho, you will come across the archives, and Virginia did an entire piece on masculinity and men and feminism and violence prevention, and it could be at that time she had done some of the work or interview with Keith Edwards. I'm not entirely sure. I remember his name coming up. Again, I'm working on the new Yin Radio website so that we can have archives to all of these, but for right now, if you go to Yin Radio and University of Idaho, you should find a stable state page that basically will direct you towards previous Yin interviews, and I believe there was one on masculinity that Virginia did, and it was just wonderful. And so that was where the rest of our interview had headed, and it was incredible information. But let's backtrack a little bit. I just want to make sure you have the resources that she was alluding to. And so, and to understand again that the NFL itself has actually gotten to this point where they are putting money back into the schools and anti-bullying programs, and there are individual NFL players that have been taking huge stances. If you look online, you'll find various websites dedicated to violence prevention and awareness, and it's just amazing. And Green Dot, GREENDOT, if you look up Vandal Green Dot on Facebook and Twitter, as she was mentioning, you'll find their pages, and you can find links to all kinds of great resources and find out about how you might be able to get involved. Also, Living the Green Dot is the national organization and gives you more details as a whole, but again, they have been through the and they continue to do the intensive trainings required, and we're just finding this huge difference being made. I also want to make sure that for anyone who needs this to know, of course, we have Alternatives to Violence of the Palouse, ATVP, and there is a 24-hour crisis line, 1-877-334-2887, if you need any help, you need anyone to speak to at all. That is who to call, 1-877-334-2887. And this is Alternatives to Violence of the Palouse. So it's about 3:55. We're going to be making a change over here into our next scheduled programming. And I just wanted to thank you for being here with us today on Yin Radio, looking into the issue of sexual assault on campus and the ways in which we're making revolutionary strides to change the culture of violence on campuses and in our community at large. Again, we interviewed Amber Morchek and Virginia Solon and heard the spoken word of Mimi Price, Samantha Hansen, and Jesse Forsmo-Shadid. Excuse me. And the next go-round on Yin Radio, that will be October 11th from 2 to 4 p.m. on KRFP 90.3. I'll be interviewing Terry Tempest Williams, the author of When Women Were Birds and Refuge, and she's just an amazing artist and writer, and I hope you'll be around to listen to that with us. But for today, I'll be saying goodbye, and thank you so much for being with us. Find us online at yinradioblog.wordpress.com, and I'll have the resources I mentioned and more information about our speakers today up and online in this next few days. Thanks so much, and take care.